So, this evening I'm going to start the teaching with a short reading from the suttas, and this one, as with a couple of readings I've done recently from a book called the Sutta Nipata, and this is a lovely collection of early Buddhist discourses, and it's a very nice translation. But just when I'm reading it, remember this is a modern English prose translation of a Pali, 2,500-year-old Pali verses done into English by a Sri Lankan monk. Okay, so his native language is Sri Lankan, although his English is very good, so it's translated into English from... Okay, so it's a complex linguistic situation, all right? So just bear that bear that in mind, okay? Now this particular, it's a few verses, eight verses from the last chapter called the Parayanavagga, the chapter which literally means the way to the beyond. And this chapter is historically very interesting in many ways, but it's a group of 16 Brahmin students who had heard, were living in a fairly distant country in the south of India, and heard about the Buddha. And they had a very old teacher called Bhavari. And it's interesting historically for a number of reasons. One reason being that the word Bhavari is actually the Pali spelling of Babylonian. So one wonders where Bhavari actually came from. They heard about this teacher, the Buddha, and they wanted to go and see him, but Bhavari said he was too old to travel all that way. So he sent his 16 students, and it traces the journey and gives all the stages on the journey and various events and so on. When they got there, the students all each asked a series of questions to the Buddha, and then got these responses, and then it has a bit of an epilogue where they returned and told Bhavari of what had happened, and where he was filled with joy, even though he was so old. Anyway, so this is one of the series of questions here. This is the questions of the Brahmin student Dhotaka Manava. So Dhotaka said to the Buddha, "Master, I so much want to hear you speak. Please, teacher, explain to me, how can a student of your teachings find the calm of Nibbana for himself?" The Buddha replied, "Any student of my teaching who is eager, intelligent and aware in this very life can find the calm of Nibbana for himself." Dhotaka said, "I can see now that there is in this world a man who has nothing, a sage, a wanderer. I bow down and honor you, sir, the one whose eye sees everything. Please," the man of the Sakyan clan, "free me from confusion." The Buddha replied, "I am not able to free anybody from confusion, but when you yourself have understood the profound teachings, then you yourself will cross this ocean of suffering." Dhotaka then replied, "Have pity on me. Please teach me the way of letting go so that I can know it as it is, so that I can live in this life in the peace and independence that's as free as the air in space." And the Buddha said, "I will explain to you that peace which is not based on hearsay and which can be attained in this very life. It is a peace which, when a mindful person understands it, releases his hold on the world." And Dhotaka said, "O teacher, it can only bring me joy to hear about this ultimate peace which, when a mindful person understands it, releases his hold on the world." And the Buddha said his last verse, "In every direction, above, below, around and within, there are things you know and recognize. When you realize that these are the things which tie you to the world, then you can let go of the thirst of craving. You can let go of the attachment to renewed existence, to future existence." So this was the verses of the Buddha and Dhotaka. So I really love these verses. I love all of these verses in these 16 sets of questions, but these ones I really love because of the Buddha's message. First of all, that it's a very hopeful message that anybody who tries, yeah, and who applies themselves well can actually free themselves from suffering. So this is a very hopeful message, but it's also a very responsible message, because the Buddha says, I can't do it, right? And this is very, very important and very brave. And you think in spiritual circles, and certainly in Indian spirituality, you know, it's very common that people think that the guru can do everything for you, yeah? So just last week we had the death of the very famous guru Sai Baba, who was one of the greatest gurus in modern India. And of course, so many people have this thing where they want to attach themselves to a teacher, and somehow through that then you can get purified. Yeah, and the Buddha is very clear. Look, I can't do it. I can't cross you over, but you have to make your own effort, and then you can cross over the flood. But I think this is very important and very encouraging. And the Buddha, see, often the thing is that we don't have that confidence in ourselves. This is something that comes across to me so much, you know, when I hearing people talking about their practice and so on, is people are so much thinking, oh, I could never do it, you know, maybe, you know, someone else can. Someone else can let go for me, yeah. But the Buddha had so much faith in people, yeah. He's always so encouraging. And when it comes down to it, the thing that he's asking us to do is, well, in a sense, yes, it's very difficult, but on the other hand, it's actually very simple. And basically, he's just asking us to let go. To let go of those things that we're attached to that lead to suffering. So he's not asking us to do anything impossible. He's not asking us to do anything which is incomprehensible. Yeah? Just mere ordinary letting go. We've all let go of something. Can you think of something you've let go of? I used to be a fan of ABBA. I let go of that. After that, I was embarrassed about being a fan of ABBA. I've let go of that too. So that's two things I've managed to let go of, so it's not too bad. But that's actually that's the process of life, is through different stages of life we're always kind of picking up new things and letting go things of the past. And one of the things about that is that you know, those things which you're so attached to, you think about when you're a child, those things which you're so attached to, you know, your teddy bear or something like that. Yeah, you love so much and you wouldn't go anywhere without it. But then later on you don't even think about it, yeah? Yeah? Well, most of sometimes maybe. Not so much anyway, but when the time's right, you just leave it behind. It's not a wrench. It's not a big deal actually. Yeah, it's just the time's right, and when you're matured in that way. So this is why this idea of letting go actually shouldn't be something which is like really scary. If what you're letting go of is really scary and threatening, then that tells you that the time is not right. Yeah. It's not right to go up to a little boy and say, I'm going to take your teddy bear away from you. You should let go. What are you being attached to the teddy bear for? Yeah, it's not right. They already haven't had the teddy bear. They'll grow up, yeah? So this is the practice. We've all got lots of teddy bears, don't we? Yeah? We've got lots of things that we hold on to that give us comfort, that give us support, and so on. And so Buddha's not saying, you know, you have to just throw away all of those things straight away. I mean, remember that these verses that the Buddha's teaching here are for somebody who's a very dedicated spiritual student already, yeah, and has been practicing for many years and so on. And actually, it's very clear from some of the other questions that that particular set of questions didn't concern meditation as such, but some of the other questions did, and they were obviously practicing very high levels of meditation. So, you know, that's the Buddha's talking there to somebody who's already quite a long way along the path. And so he's not trying to take away things from me, he's not trying to deny from things. What he is trying to do, I think, is to encourage us to have the confidence, yeah, that we can do it. Yeah? So when he says, you know, I can't cross you over, he's not abandoning you. If that was all he said, then that would be a bit depressing, right? You might have a bit of despair. But you yourself make the effort, and you yourself can cross over the flood. And so this is that kind of message which the Buddha is giving. One of the topics themes, I think, which has been discussed in religious circles quite a lot recently, it's happened in various ways here in Sydney and in different ways in different parts of the world, is the notion of how religions relate to secularism. So, you know, if we have this kind of secular world which operates as if kind of material and social and so on kind of things were real, but doesn't really have any kind of sense of the transcendent, yeah? So that it's a way secular societies kind of organize people and stuff on a more or less functional basis so people can get by, yeah? Go supply the minimum of things. So you have like human rights, you know, so things like that. And human rights kind of is a secular idea, and human rights, well, yeah, you can have an education and an equal wage and access to healthcare and all of those things, but it doesn't tell you anything about what to do once you've got all those things, right? How do you actually live? You can have all your equal rights, and that's good, but where does it go? What does it mean? Yeah? And so this is what secularism can't really address. And so I think this is something which is the really crucial distinction that religions, and especially in this context Buddhism, do offer, is something which is beyond that. So this is what the Buddha is offering to Dhotaka, yeah, saying that, you know, actually it's not just about these things which we do and how we live for what we experience here and now. And elsewhere in those series of questions, he makes that more explicit as well. So there's this kind of everyday or worldly benefit which we can look to for Buddhist practice, and then there's something which is left over. So when we approach Buddhist practice today, you know, we can package Buddhism in secular ways, yeah? So for example, the center we're in here, you know, is more or less a secular center. I mean, John's kind of not entirely secular, okay, he's got a big Buddha image there. But hey, lots of people have Buddha images in their gardens and things like that, so it's not quite... But it still is kind of this using Buddhism in therapy and things like that in order to overcome depression, anxiety, and stress, and all of these things. I'm sure that all of us have practiced meditation and practiced Dhamma to one degree or another, and realize it actually really does work. It is actually really good for those things. And that's one of the things that I, you know, noticed on this retreat that we just did last weekend. You know, how so many of the people there, you know, come for, you know, what are fairly often very, very simple or very kind of obvious reasons, you know, that they're kind of feeling very stressed or they're feeling very depressed or something like that. And for some strange reason, they've got this idea that, that spending 5 days being silent and sitting still is going to help you feel less depressed. Which is not entirely obvious if you think about it, right? In other circles, it might seem to be a symptom of depression if you're just sitting there not doing anything, not talking, you know, a bunch of people sitting there not talking to each other for that day. So you may well think there's something fairly disturbing about that. But you know, it's amazing. It really does work, and it really does help to alleviate. So, I mean, and you can see that in those very kind of specific things. And sometimes, you know, you can sit there for so many hours and meditate, and then it's just like a specific thing that will make all the difference. For example, I remember one thing was stuck in my mind was one of the meditators had a vision, and they're doing the meditation, and this. The person had just been through a lot of suffering with personal suffering and strife of various kinds, and then they had this vision. The vision was just a sunny room, sitting in meditation. Suddenly this thing just came, a sunny room, and then a child in the room, and like a child's bedroom. And then they're thinking, oh, you know, they didn't recognize him, they didn't know who that was. And all of a sudden, then they just realized, oh, this is my bedroom. That's me. Yeah? And they went and gave themselves a big hug. Yeah? And it's just at that moment, that image. I mean, that image was very beautiful. I mean, it's, in a way, it's quite cliched, you know, the whole inner child thing. I mean, it's a bit of a cliche. But when it actually happens, it's not a cliche, right? When it actually happens, it's very deeply meaningful. And what was powerful for me about that image was the clarity of it. Yeah, the clarity of that insight, that person realized that actually this was something that they, it wasn't something that they'd been told, wasn't something that I'd said or anything like that. There was an insight that they actually had for themselves. And then they realized in that moment that they had lost sight of this, and that they had been looking for happiness through parents and through family and all of these things, all of whom down the line had let them down very badly. And so, you know, there'd been a whole history behind that. So they'd been always kind of investing in seeking to be loved by somebody else. Yeah? When I feel loved by somebody else, then I'll be okay. And just in that moment, in that one image, they realize actually that they have that love within themselves. Yeah? And with that love within themselves, then they're going to be okay. And that really made a huge difference to them in that retreat. The kind of the whole emotional state just shifted with that one kind of image. But of course, that was them. You know, that was their journey, their image, their archetype, their whatever happened. Might affect you or me to a greater or lesser degree, but still there's something in it which is very personal. But what was impressive to me about that, as I mentioned before, was the clarity of it. Yeah. So this is something in meditation. You know, we do have insights and so on and so forth, and those insights come to us in different ways. Now that particular one was a visual image. Yeah, it arose as a visual image, and that was also part of that. The meaning of that within that journey as well, because for that person, they had actually in their childhood been a very creative and artistic person, but that was one of the things which had just dropped away and been kind of ground out of them for all of that time, and they hadn't done any artwork or visual creative things for such a long time. So the fact that it appeared as an image, which of course they then went away and drew, yeah, it was actually became part of that becoming in contact with that. But of course it doesn't have to be an image, yeah? And often it might not be an image. Sometimes it might be a word, yeah, or a phrase, yeah. You just hear it in your mind. And sometimes you can actually hear very clearly. Yeah? So some people say they'll actually hear that word. Here's something said. And it really sounds like a kind of a voice in your head, you know? And it can just be a word of insight. Or sometimes it's just a knowing. Yeah? Insight happens in so many different ways. Sometimes it's just a knowing. Something just arises in your mind and you just know, oh. That's how it is. Or sometimes it's not even like that. Sometimes it's very physical. Sometimes the mind will just kind of settle and kind of tensions and energies in your body which you didn't even know were there just disappear. You know, those tensions resolve. So these are some of the different ways that insight can arise, you know, when we're practicing. And the forms of those insights don't really matter. The forms of those insights will vary according to the person and the circumstance and so on. What matters is what effect does that have? Yeah? That's what tells you whether it's a real insight or not. Yeah? Does it actually change anything? Yeah? And so, of course, it's easy enough to have kind of intellectual insights about things. Yeah? You can sit and discuss things or read them and yes, I understand this and that and that. But the real insight actually changes you. Yeah? And it actually resolves that tension and eases that suffering which you've had. And that's how you know when it's a real insight and it's a genuine insight. Not because of the form that it comes in, but because of the effect that it has. Now, when you experience that, one of the things that you experience, you notice in that transformation and that experience, that there's very often two characteristics of that experience on an emotional level, two characteristics. One characteristic is a feeling of release that comes from letting go. Yeah? There's a feeling like I've been carrying something around with me and I'm putting it down. Yeah? And even if you're not in the kind of the Buddhist, you know, if you're not using the Buddhist terminology of like attachment and letting go and so on, even just in ordinary language, you know, you say, well, I'm carrying a lot of baggage or something like that, yeah? It's, we still have this idea, we're carrying a lot of things around. So we put down the baggage, yeah? And that's often what we do on retreat, sometimes in a very literal way. I remember one story was this Thai meditation monk, Ajahn Lee, and he was teaching a retreat once and they were going to catch a train to the retreat center. And when everyone showed up at the train station, they saw everyone was carrying these huge suitcases and packs of stuff and all of this kind of thing, and they're all going on this retreat to let go. And he just kind of looked at it and he just started walking down the train tracks, and everyone had to follow him. Right? So he just walked beside the train tracks and everyone had to grab all their baggage and follow him. And by the time they'd walked a couple of miles down there, these packs were getting so heavy they just started throwing things out. And then he waited until they'd thrown most of their luggage away. And then he said, okay. So then they said, they got, and then they caught the train the rest of the journey. So there's sometimes the baggage is literal, yeah? And sometimes actually doing that and making the metaphor literal actually helps, yeah? It actually really does help to let go. So this is one side of it, is that ease that comes from the letting go, a sense of release. So in a sense that's kind of a negative side, in the sense that it's just a freedom from something. It doesn't have any essence itself. It's just a sense of relief, being freed from a pressure. But then the positive side that also comes with that is a sense of confidence and a sense of inner self-worth, yeah? That kind of love that comes from the metta, the feeling of just that feeling, this is really true, and it's something that I can do and I can experience, yeah. And as those verses were saying, you know, it is something that you can do in this very life, you can do here and now, that letting go. And you realize, oh, I can let go. And so in that act it gives you so much confidence, yeah, to where you really feel, okay, actually this is something I can do. And so it's interesting, these are the two qualities that's really mentioned in those verses to Dhotaka, yeah? Or emphasized there, the letting go and the confidence that comes from the letting go. So these qualities are things that you know, these when we're practicing Dhamma for these kind of limited or secular purposes, you know, and we want to overcome our depression, we want to feel more loving, we want to be less anxious, then when we're practicing with those motivations in mind and we have these kind of insights and so on, that will tend to come and go, yeah? And again, I'm sure you've all experienced this, where, you know, you can have a sort of feeling of letting go and understanding and feeling of wisdom and whatever, and coming through meditation or through something else, some kind of insight. Oh, it all seems clear. But then maybe a few hours later or maybe a few days later, it's like, it doesn't seem so clear anymore. Yeah? And those things which you thought you'd kind of resolved are maybe not quite as resolved as you thought they were, yeah? Not to say that it disappears completely, but it's just to say that it's not, it's still just part of conditions, yeah? Our level of clarity in you know, improves and goes downhill and other problems arise and so on. Our mind is always changing, yeah? And the insights don't always stay there, yeah? Insights are not permanent. We can lose insights just as we gain them. Einstein said that he only really understood the theory of relativity on occasional moments of exceptional mental lucidity. Yeah? Yeah, so it's only occasionally, yeah, that he actually really, really got it. So these things, they come and go. When we sit in retreat or we practice meditation, we have that kind of realization, that insight, and then it's very easy to lose it later. But still, even though that's the case, there is something about it which has a lasting quality, doesn't it? Yeah? It doesn't really go completely, even though you can kind of get caught up and forget things. But still, somehow there's a sense that, you know, you've been there, that there's somehow it doesn't go completely. And I think this is like part of how it informs our kind of overall development. I made in the retreat, I sort of talked a little bit about the distinction between states and structures of consciousness. So state of consciousness being something which you experience at one time. So, you know, when you're sitting in meditation, you can have a state where your mind maybe is clear or bright or something like that. And then that state of consciousness will change, yeah? And that brightness and that clarity and so on will disappear completely. But there's also like another aspect of consciousness which is more long term, and that's like the structures of consciousness. And that structures of consciousness are less apparent than states. I mean, a state of consciousness is something that you just sit and you look and you see it. You can't see a structure in the same way. A structure is like a pattern that you can observe and learn from. Yeah, which you can see different patterns of behavior and thought and so on over different kinds of emotional reactions and things, which these kind of make up our personality. So when you have these realizations in meditation and these insights, then even though the state of consciousness will change, but they will still inform the structures of consciousness. Yeah, it doesn't disappear completely. So it will still affect those patterns. How those patterns recur in the future will be influenced by that insight, hopefully in a good way. Now, when we're approaching Dhamma practice, again, approaching from our individual backgrounds, in our individual life journeys and so on, and with our different motivations, then different aspects of the Dhamma can appear to be of different kinds of importance. Yeah, and so you hear this quite a lot in Buddhist circles. Some people say, "Oh, you only have to meditate, and that's all that really matters." Or other people will say, "Oh, you have to study the suttas, and that's what really matters." Or other people say this or say that. So people have different kind of opinions about what's really important. And of course, there's no resolution to that argument, because the reality is that for the most part, well, there are things that's important for that person at that time, yeah, and it's not necessarily important for another person. Actually, to really develop the path involves all of those things, yeah, and the development of the Eightfold Path, yeah. So, in secular Buddhism, what we've seen is the adoption of certain aspects of Buddhism, most obvious one being mindfulness, yeah? So you have this adoption of mindfulness that's become a real buzzword in psychology and all of these kinds of things. So everything's mindfulness, 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 of course, it being one of the factors of the Eightfold Path, yeah? And so the Buddha never said mindfulness is the answer to everything. Yeah? Mindfulness is one aspect of the Eightfold Path. I was talking earlier with Dana, I was saying that this was famous dispute in foundational dispute in the history of Tibetan Buddhism. When Buddhism first arrived in Tibet, there was a number of different teachers, I think around the 7th, 8th century, a number of different teachers from different schools and so on came there, and different people were teaching in different ways. And the king decided that he wanted to become a Buddhist and wanted to adopt Buddhism as the state religion, but he was unsure about what form of Buddhism that he should adopt. And so at that time there was a famous monk from China and a famous monk from India in Lhasa. So he invited them to have a debate, and the outcome of the debate would determine the future of Buddhism in Tibet. And the Chinese monk was teaching, was a Chan teacher, so he taught basically Chan, is the Chinese origin of what we more commonly know today as Zen. And the Indian monk was from the Vajrayana school of Buddhism. And the Chan monk's basic tenet was that mindfulness and awareness by itself is enough. Right? Everything in the Dhamma is included within mindful awareness. So if you have that power of just knowing, then that in itself will encompass all dhammas, and that's all you need for purification. And of course the Indian monk says, no! No, the Buddha taught many different kinds of methods, many practices, yeah? And all of them have a role and all of them have a purpose. You can't just throw out all of the different practices and say just mindful awareness is alone is enough. And he said it's like a disease or illness in the body, where if you have different kinds of illness, then you need different kinds of medicine to treat them. And the Chinese monk responded, well, yes, that's true, but you can, according, he said that there's one medicine, is ginger, which you can use to treat any illness. So I don't know, it doesn't sound like particularly reliable medical advice to me. But that was the argument. And so the king decided in favour of the Indian monk and kicked the Chinese out, with, of course, consequences that are still being felt today. So, you know, this is a kind of a live issue, you know, within the Buddhist world. It's not just us today that are having this debate about the role of mindfulness and how it integrates with other Buddhist practices. It's part of the whole tradition of Buddhism. So this is very much what's happening in the secular world. The secular world appropriates certain parts of Buddhism or whatever that it can digest and that it can fit into its own structure, and then leaves out other things. And there's, of course, nothing wrong with that. Yeah, that's what it has to do. That's how it works. But that approach by itself is still leaving aside that transcendent dimension. So what the Buddha is talking about to Dhotaka, he's pointing very firmly and very clearly to this transcendent dimension, this dimension of Nibbana. And Nibbana is not just about not feeling depressed anymore. It's not just about not being anxious anymore. It's not just about making sure that you're mindful. Yes, Nibbana is not depressive, and it's not, you don't feel anxious and so on. So it is all of those things, but there's something else. So there's like a sense of the highest or the ultimate in Buddhism. There's something to strive for, something to attain, something to aspire to, yeah, something to look up to. And that what that is, right, what Nibbana actually is, well, it's difficult to kind of pin down. I mean, that in a sense is again one of the great controversies in Buddhist philosophy. How do you actually define the indefinable? But the most important point about Nibbana is that the realization and the truth of Nibbana, the actual experience of it by an individual, is based on exactly the same dhammas, exactly the same principles that work within that ordinary worldly secular sphere. Yeah? So the same qualities of letting go, of confidence, the ones that I picked out for emphasis here, I could have picked out a lot of others, but these qualities, they help us to overcome anxiety and depression and all of these things, which is all very good. But they also, when we keep on developing them, you don't just stop there. You don't just think, oh, well, I used to be suffering from depression and now I'm okay, and then stop. But you keep on developing them and keep on going deeper and deeper and deeper. And it's when you start doing that that these things really start to reveal themselves and really start to show their own truth. There is so much more to our mind that we are just unaware of. Our potential, our capacity, when the mind is really free, is something which is just astonishing. It's just beyond our comprehension. And so keeping going with these practices, yeah, using them not just to escape symptoms, not just to get by, but using them with that aspiration for the highest, yeah, that aspiration for what is transcendent. This is, and then this will just keep on increasing that sense of self-confidence, that sense of peace and freedom. And I personally, I very firmly believe that this kind of transcendent reality that we call Nibbana is actually a truth. It is, as the Buddha says in his verses, something which can be realized. Anybody who's reasonably intelligent and reasonably diligent and applies themselves to practice can realize that. I very firmly believe that. So this is what it comes up to. So what it comes back to is that it's up to each of us to be able to cross over the flood. Yeah? It's up to the efforts that we make. The practice that we put in, this is what makes the difference. It's not about having some guru who's going to carry you over. It's not about having some kind of special teaching or initiation which is just going to do it all for you. It's about those ordinary, everyday dhammas which all of you have already experienced. And you've already experienced letting go. You've already experienced loving kindness. You've already experienced a sense of self-confidence, you've already experienced a sense of energy, all of those things which you've already felt within yourselves. If we keep on developing those, keep on going, yeah, keep on working with those things, then that's what will lead to Nibbana. So this is my talk for you this evening on the Dhotaka Manava Puccha, and I offer that for your reflection and ask if there's any comments or questions. Alright, so let's finish up by paying respects.
Sāvaka-saṅgho